You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon members. Thank you so much.
Join our Patreon for extra episodes, interviews, extra content, and to help support the podcast and help us continue to do the work we do.
Go to patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl to learn more. The statue of Zeus at Olympia is the stickiest of the statues.
It was a sweaty, stinky, bloody, poopy mess. I'm Jen McMenemy.
And I'm Jenny Williamson.
And this is Ancient History Fangirl, the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World edition. The second episode in this series, Jenny. Woohoo!
Woohoo! It is the second episode, isn't it? My gosh, how far we've come.
How far we've come. I can already tell you that this season will not only be seven episodes.
It's already not, because I did two episodes on the Great Pyramid, so.
And we did an introductory episode as well. So it was always going to be at least eight.
We've already got ideas to expand things. We cannot be stopped.
We will not be stopped. Can't stop, won't stop. So, in our last episode, Jenny set the stage so brilliantly, explaining the importance of the wonders, how they were chosen, ancient colonialism, and why making lists was such an important thing to the ancients and to us in the modern day. I love a good list. I live for a sexy spreadsheet. Jenny, stop looking at me like that. You know I love spreadsheets and pen and paper lists.
I mean, I'm never going to judge your love of lists. Spreadsheets are not for me. Spreadsheets give me stress hives, but you do you.
Just don't know why they're so easy.
All the grids, I just can't look at it. I can't look at it. I'm getting stressed out thinking about it.
So when we divvied up the list of the seven wonders, there was only one that I was like really psyched to cover. And that was the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. The other wonders, I was pretty like amenable to covering, but I had no standout favorites. So when it came time to cover today's episode, I did not have high hopes. When my ADHD acts up, slogging through research can be a real trial, and I could feel my attention and focus waning as I began to wade into the research about the statue of Zeus at Olympia. Jenny, I have never been so pleasantly pleased to be wrong about a topic. Because let me tell you, this statue has everything. Curses. Lovers' names engraved on fingers, sweaty, oily, naked men, afternoon delight, passing out from the exhaustion of the heat and maybe lovemaking, so much fucking, and the Olympics. I could go on, maybe you want me to go on, but let's not spoil this episode too much. And I want to shout out at the top of this episode the invaluable source that is Bettany Hughes's Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. This book was just released in the UK, and it's out in the US this month. Bettany's book is absolutely incredible. It brings these wonders to life. It gives you the best facts and knowledge about the people and culture, and doles out enough mythology and mythological references to make me just so happy. I really recommend it, and it's safe to say that this episode wouldn't be possible without that research. So, without further ado, let's dive into the Statue of Zeus at Olympia. First and foremost, when you Google this statue, you have to be very specific. Why? Well, there is a temple in Athens, or the ruins of a temple, that is called the Temple of Olympian Zeus. And when I was doing my research, it was impossible not to be bombarded with so many tourist travelogues about that temple. And I've been there. We actually put up a video about those ruins on our Patreon. Jenny and Liv from Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, discuss the importance of this temple. It's great, but let me be very, very clear. The Temple of Olympian Zeus and the Statue of Zeus at Olympia are not the same thing.
That sounds real confusing. I would also be confused by that.
And it was so difficult because I was so excited to like watch some documentaries and really like go down a YouTube rabbit hole in addition to like having this incredible like written source and, you know, other things. And I was so disappointed that it was just lots and lots of travel logs. I was like, oh, they're not the same thing. So, as I mentioned, one is located in Athens. You can actually stand in the ruins of this temple and look up towards the Parthenon and like see it dominating. This is not the case with the statue of Olympian Zeus. That statue was located at a temple high up in Olympia, Greece, in the sacred Altis Grove. It's confusing, but the distinction is important. Was the statue of Zeus at Olympia also in a temple? Yes, but it wasn't a temple in Athens.
Now that we've got all of that cleared up, let's talk about this smoking hot statue. It's a smoke show. I think it probably, if there was any smoke, there might be fire, and then the statue might be on fire because of all the oil, which would just make it more terrifying.
We'll get there.
Anyway, it is kind of important to understand when this statue was built. Now, the temple at Olympia and the worship of Zeus, the All-Father, father of all the Greeks, also the Fuck-Father, apparently.
Fuck Daddy Zeus is definitely right.
This religion, the worship of Zeus, had existed long before the statue was constructed. But the building of the statue at this time had a lot to do with, well, Athens and another very impressive temple structure, the Acropolis. So picture it, you guys. It's mid-5th century BC, which is the 450s BC. Always get that confused. In ancient Greece. In Athens, the Delian League, led by Pericles, you know, Aspasia's lover, her boyfriend, her, you know, much older boyfriend, could be her dad, but isn't.
Her sugar daddy, maybe. Yeah. Obviously, famous statesman, blah, blah, blah. But I just like referring to him as Aspasia's lover, and I will do that forever because it's my podcast.
Yeah, fair. Anyway, Pericles and his buddies, the Delian League people, were consolidating their power. They were building epic temples and monuments, including the Parthenon. Construction on the Parthenon began in 447 BC and finished in 438 BC, although final touches and decorations continued on the complex until 432 BC. The Parthenon in Athens was part of the Acropolis Temple complex. It also served as the treasury for the Delian League. And, to be honest, there was a lot of hard feelings about so much power being placed in Athens. People outside of Athens were not thrilled with this, but for the sake of peace, it stayed this way for a while. Why was this important? Well, the person who created two of the biggest sculptures in the Acropolis complex was none other than Phidias, the same sculptor who would go on to carve the sculpture of Zeus at Olympia. Phidias, who we'll talk more about in a little while, was a master artist. He famously carved two epic statues of Athena, which were featured at the Acropolis. One was the Athena Parthenos, which stood inside the Parthenon. The other was a massive bronze statue of Athena, the Athena Promachos. This statue was 30 feet tall and stood looming over Athens between the Propylaea and the Parthenon on the Acropolis. What's the Propylaea?
I think the Propylaea is sort of the approach to the Parthenon, I think. It was out in the open, this statue. It was like just looming over, just standing there, glaring down at you.
Okay, so just to picture this, this Athena was outside of the Parthenon on the Acropolis, glaring down at the city 30 feet tall. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
Cool. She could be seen from anywhere in the city. She could be seen by anyone visiting the city. You just couldn't not see her. She was always in your sight line.
Yes, she was. And this Athena, she was called the Athena who fights in the front line, was a terrifying, towering message to anyone who visited Athens. Our goddess, the goddess of our city, will kick your ass, and we used your money to build this.
It's a flex.
It's a total flex. And the statue of Athena remained watching over Athens for about 1,000 years. She was a marvel carved out of solid bronze. But she was just the beginning, the appetizer for the feast that would be the statue of Zeus at Olympia. When the Temple of Zeus at Olympia was completed in about 460 BC, It was so impressive. At the time, it was the biggest temple complex in ancient Greece. The builders of the Parthenon actually ever so slightly extended their temple complex to make it just that tiny bit bigger than Olympia. Because worshiping ancient gods was all about who had the biggest dick. I mean, temple.
Phidias got himself into a little bit of trouble when he was working on the statues in the Acropolis, and that trouble saw him being run out of Athens. This is a quote from an article on The Collector called "The Statue of Zeus at Olympia, a Lost Wonder." Quote, "Right after finishing Athena's statue, Phidias was blamed for embezzlement by the enemies of his friend and prominent Athenian statesman Pericles. They said that he had taken some of the gold that was used to build the statue and, like, just taken it for himself, right?"
They did. They said some of the gold or the bronze that was used to build the statue. They accused him of, like, padding his orders so that, like, he ordered extra just for himself.
Oh, naughty, naughty, Phidias. In the end, Phidias was relieved of the charges after proving that he used the right amount of gold on the statue. Still, he did not manage to fend off the second wave of accusations. Apparently, he had depicted himself and Pericles on the shield of the goddess, which was a great hubris. This time, Phidias had to leave Athens to save himself. It was probably this misfortune that brought the sculptor to the sanctuary of Zeus at Olympia.
And I really wanted to include that quote because, first, it gives us a really good insight into Phidias and his pal Pericles.
It gives us an insight into, like, how contentious this time was. You know, like, I'm not sure if these accusations had any merit to them, but it just kind of seems like there were people who were just dying to attack Pericles in any way that they could, and that would include attacking the people around him and utterly ruining their lives.
Absolutely. But it also shows a little bit about the ego and the drive of these two men. And that's important for what's to come. I mean, he's accused of hubris, and he did commit hubris. He put himself and Pericles on the shield of Athena. You don't do that. You don't depict yourself on the goddess's shield.
I feel like that's so questionable, though. Like, I could just imagine a bunch of guys standing there looking 30 feet up at a shield going, well, does that look like them? I guess it could look like them. Oh, no, it's definitely them. Well, how do you know?
First off, this is something that Phidias does do. Spoiler with the statue of Zeus. I imagine that this was somewhere quite prominent that people could see it. And also probably before the shield was put into place, they would have been able to see it when they were carving it. So I think it's not, in my opinion, questionable whether or not he did this. I think he did this. I think the gold thing, he proved he didn't do that. But, and I also kind of feel like, well, that's a big flex for him. And he's like, okay, so prove that I didn't do this incredible thing that you could do. Oh, you can't.
Just a little bit of a harmless self-insert, okay?
If you could, you would. Like, who are you kidding? And Pericles, he's the guy who made it happen. So, of course, it's his acknowledgments, right? Like, that's it.
It's his dedication.
The people of Athens, particularly the upper classes, were not pleased with said dedication. So that's the setting for what was at stake with these giant edifices of worship and how Phidias came to be in a sort of backwater that is Olympia. Let's talk a little bit about the location of Olympia. So the statue of Zeus at Olympia is the only wonder of the ancient world, according to the ancient list that we're using, that was located on mainland Greece. And it was located tucked away up in the Peloponnese Mountains. And the location here is important because this temple and the pilgrimage that people took to get to this temple was unlike any other in the ancient world.
Olympia was the site of the ancient Olympic Games. Greeks from all across the classical world traveled to take part in these games. This was a warlike time, and the Greek city-states were always fighting. But when the athletes traveled to this competition from all over the Greek world, they traveled under a banner of peace. It was forbidden to declare war while the Olympic Games were on. Bettany Hughes, in her book Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, details this trip to the temple sanctuary. Quote, "To get to Zeus's sanctuary home at Olympia is necessarily a pilgrimage. A traveler from Ephesus would have had to negotiate the Anatolian coast, cross the Aegean, and brave the Rhodope, Olympus, and Pindus mountain ranges. From the west and south, the journey would have been via vast stretches of the Mediterranean at its most dangerous. From the north, along bandit roads. A steady trickle of travelers beat a path to Olympia year in, year out, but once every 4 years, there was a flood of men."
Yeah, and I just wanted to stop here for a minute before we get to the flood of men. I included that quote because it really shows you how removed and isolated the sanctuary was and how much of a pilgrimage it was to get there. And that's really important because it's kind of unlike a lot of the other big, large sort of temple complexes that we see, like the Acropolis, places in Corinth, which is in a city. I mean, Delphi's kind of tucked away, but the Temple of Sinyon, they're all places that are much more easily accessible. So the statue received many pilgrims every year. The temple complex, which was extensive, didn't just have a grand temple to Zeus. It also had temples to many other gods, including the goddess Hera. In fact, the site was originally sacred to Hera, and over time was co-opted by worship of Zeus. The sacrificial altar on the site was originally closer to the temple of Hera and not Zeus. It was moved closer to the temple of Zeus when this became less of a joint place of worship and more about the worship of Zeus, the all-father leather daddy. Sorry.
I mean, I feel like I see something in this about a patriarchal sky god overtaking an older matriarchal goddess worship tradition. I don't know if that's the case, but I feel like that was a thing that happened in the Bronze Age.
You're absolutely right. That is what's happening. And that is why this statue and the worship of it here is so important. This is a real change of this patriarchal sky god and the patriarchy being cemented. It's also why before sort of like the age of Pericles, the temple that would have been at Olympia, which we'll talk about in a little bit, was very different from the huge complex it became.
Yeah. So this temple of Olympian Zeus and this temple complex even before that.
No, it's not the temple of Olympian Zeus. It's the temple at Olympia.
Temple of Zeus at Olympia.
Yes, I know. It's easy to do.
You'll need to correct me on that a lot. Yeah, I feel like this whole Zeus statue situation, it seems like, you know, gender colonization.
You're not wrong. It is something that was definitely an undercurrent in Bettany Hughes's book. I don't get into it too much here because she really contrasts it a lot with the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which I'm going to cover later. So I'm going to kind of save that for a bit later. That might be wind up being two episodes. I'm not sure. I really wanted to give you like what Bettany Hughes shows is like a lot of maleness because I just so much male energy. And I was just like, this is
why do we need all that male energy? Because they're trying to oppress something that was there before.
Absolutely. The interesting thing was there were temples to Artemis here and to Hera and Athena and other goddesses. They were worshipped here. They had their own places of worship. But sometimes I think particularly when you talk about Artemis and Athena and even Hera, there's like an undercurrent of how they feed into the patriarchy or how they are outside of because of their decisions not to be with men. Like Artemis essentially is a Peter Pan character. She never grows up.
If you listen to our Gender Rebels series, we start with queer women, and it's all about the way that specifically ancient Greek culture erased the existence of queer women or the existence of women's sexuality outside of home, hearth, and family. Like, if you are going to be outside of the patriarchy, you can't have a sexuality or you are essentially asexual, like Artemis. Although there is an undercurrent of queerness in some of Artemis's mythology, which we talk about there, too.
There's not just an undercurrent. There is an there's an overt current of queerness.
Yeah, like it's there. It is absolutely there. So yeah, like I see like this is like about this very specific dominant conception of male sexuality, which is all about domination, colonizing women's sexuality and like a tradition of feminine worship, which must have been older and perhaps which allowed room for an Artemis with a sex life. I don't know. Not that she didn't have a sex life because there was a queer Artemis, but like allowed room for a queer Artemis, right?
Potentially, but that's not the Artemis that we're going to get here. Originally, probably, but now that we're into this time period, we're talking about what happened with this temple. That is done. This is now about Zeus. So we are going to talk about why every 4 years this temple became flooded with men. But it's important to note that yearly, this temple was a place of pilgrimage. Men and women traveled here to seek advice and guidance from the gods, particularly from Zeus, because this was the place where it was believed that Zeus was watching over and taking care of all of the Hellenes, all of the Greeks. Now, do not confuse Olympia with Mount Olympus. They are nowhere near each other. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
So confusing.
I know. We'll talk about where Mount Olympus is located. Essentially, I believe it's 750 miles to the north, and it's the highest mountain in all of Greece. That's where Zeus lived. But Olympia was obviously, you know, named for that site and was more centrally located in the Peloponnese. But anyway, I digress. Before kings went to war, they went to the Temple of Zeus at Olympia to see the statue, or when the statue wasn't there, to see the site and consult with the oracle there. If the oracle gave them a favorable or true prediction, then the kings would have to return and give a part of their plunder over to the temple. Like, it was kind of a tithe that they were paying.
You mean if the prediction came true, they had to come and pay a tithe?
Essentially, yeah. of some of their plunder. And when they went originally, they had to obviously give the statue something, you know, give the temple something to get that prediction, you know.
You got to pay up either way.
Either way, the statue wins. I mean, the temple wins.
The house always wins at the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, okay? It's Jenny and Jen here to tell you about our new favorite novel, Orphea and Eurydiceus by Elise John. Orphea dreams of something more than the warrior craft she's been forced to learn. Hidden away on a far-flung island, her blood sings with poetry, and her words can move flowers to bloom and forests to grow. But her father, the sun god Apollo, has forbidden her this art.
A chance meeting with a young shieldmaker, Eurydiceus, gives her the courage to use her voice. After wielding all her gifts to defeat one final champion, Orphea draws the scrutiny of the gods. Performing her poetry, she wins the protection of the goddesses of the arts, the powerful muses, who welcome her to their sanctuary on Mount Parnassus. Orphea learns to hone her talents, crafting words of magic infused with history, love, and tragedy.
When Eurydiceus joins her, Orphea struggles with her desire for fame and her budding love. As her bond with the gentle shieldmaker grows, she joins the Argonauts on their quest for the Golden Fleece. Orphea earns unparalleled fame, but she longs to return to Eurydiceus.
Yet she has a darker journey to make, one which will see her fight for her love with all the power of her poetry.
You can purchase Orphea and Eurydiceus on Amazon, the HarperCollins website, or anywhere books are sold. Being a part of a royal family might seem enticing, but more often than not, it comes at the expense of everything else, like your freedom, your privacy, and sometimes even your head.
Wondery's new podcast, Even the Royals, pulls back the curtain on royal families, past and present, from all over the world, to show you the darker side of what it means to be royalty.
From icons like Grace Kelly, Oscar-winning actress turned Princess of Monaco, who the world saw as the ultimate good girl, she mastered playing a happy wife and mother, but beneath it all, she was desperately lonely. Grace spent her whole life working towards perfection, and it ultimately cost her her happiness.
Or King Ludwig II from Bavaria. He was only 18 when his father died, leaving the crown to him and a duty to rule that he never wanted. He refused to lead and used funds from the royal treasury to further his extreme love of opera. But this choice eventually cost him the crown and his life.
Follow Even the Royals on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge Even the Royals ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So over time, this temple complex, because it was many things inside of it, it wasn't just the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, it was a whole complex. Over time, this temple complex became very rich in plunder, making it a place that was rife for bandits and thieves. During the heyday of the temple, it was heavily protected. But in the final years of the temple's life, it was constantly attacked and plundered. We'll talk about that later.
So people did go to see this temple yearly, but what about the ones who arrived every 4 years? Why did they go to the site? What is happening at Olympia that is so important, and why only men? Well, every 4 years, the Olympics took place at Olympia, that's why. Beginning in 776 BC, these games took place every 4 years and were open to all male Greek citizens. The definition of what it meant to be a Greek citizen changed over time, and it's kind of questionable because I feel like people weren't citizens of Greece as a place. Like, it was more like you were citizens of various city-states, right?
Exactly, and those city-states had their own rules, so I didn't want to, like, go down a rabbit hole of what it meant to be someone who could compete in these games. So I'm just going to say citizens, but it was only men. You know, they all had to be approved as citizenship of their city state or island or wherever they're from. And, it, you know, we could probably write a dissertation on what it meant to be a citizen of whatever place, you know. So we're just going to gloss over a little.
It's probably different from place to place.
Wildly different.
As far as I understand, there wasn't like a Greek citizenship.
There was nothing that was codified because all of these people felt that they were Hellenes, but they were all their own individual city-states and they all had their own wars and didn't like this one and that one. So they all came together, but they all also didn't like each other.
Right. Greece was not a unified country. So anyway, the definition of what it meant to be a Greek citizen changed over time. It was a requirement to be a citizen of a Greek city-state for participation in the games, as Jen said. The games would be announced by different heralds going across all the regions of Greece to call the men to arms or competition. And we do mean all areas of Greece, both on the mainland in Anatolia and all the different Greek islands. Attendance was an honor, and fighting or waylaying anyone else while they traveled to the games was forbidden. Because during the Olympics, war and fighting amongst the other Greek city-states was strictly forbidden. You were not allowed to fight during the Olympics. Bettany Hughes explains why this is the case. Quote, "There were compelling reasons for ancient Greeks to comply with this rule. A serious fine of 2 minae, or 200 drachmas, per soldier in combat. When Sparta attacked the city of Leprium during the Olympics in 420 BC, for example, the city-state was fined 2,000 minae, loosely equivalent to 500,000 pounds in today's money, which is like, I don't know, $750,000. I'm not sure what the exchange rate is, but it's a lot. We should not imagine, though, that the Olympic truce was primarily designed to generate peace in the world. It was designed to ensure the safe passage of athletes and pilgrims to Olympia so that these men could fetishize competition in the presence of the king of the gods."
And fetishize they did.
Oh, I bet they did.
Because these games were all about showing their love and devotion to Zeus. Let's say it that way. All the games took place naked. This included things like wrestling, running, boxing, etc. And these games took place out of the sight of prying eyes, particularly the prying eyes of the ancient Greek men's wives. This temple to the sky god was quite literally in the mountains near the sky. It wasn't an easy trek, even for those who were on the mainland. And that makes it quite different from some other temples, like the Acropolis, which is located in the heart of Athens, the Temple of Olympian Zeus, again in Athens, or the Temple of Poseidon at Sinion, which overlooks the Aegean. I mean, those are just the ones that I've been to, which are pretty convenient to get to. Even Delphi, it's up in the mountains, but it's not that difficult to get to. This temple complex and eventually the statue of Zeus were a destination, one that forced people to make a pilgrimage to visit it. And that is important because it made this a sort of destination site for worship, and that would build its legacy. Because these mountains, this site, had been famous long before the statue was built. And before you ask the question I asked, no, this temple in Olympia is nowhere near Mount Olympus, which is in northern Greece and the tallest mountain on the mainland. I think it's something like 750 miles away. Mount Olympus was believed to be where all the Olympian gods lived. Olympia was where the Olympics, games to honor Zeus, were held every 4 years. Confused?
Yes.
The site was famous for a few different myths, one of which involved the creation of the Olympic Games. Now, weirdly, I didn't set out to write an episode about the Olympic Games, but it's kind of impossible to talk about this particular statue and not talk about the Olympic Games. At least a little bit. I'll try to keep the deep dive on the short side in case we want to cover it more in the future.
The Olympic Games began in the 720s BC, long before the statue of Zeus at Olympia was created, which was in the 400s BC. The Olympics happened every 4 years, and only Greek men could compete. No women were allowed to witness these games, except the priestess of Demeter. She oversaw the games. Otherwise, women were not allowed into the games on penalty of death. And that's not to say that women and non-Greeks weren't in Olympia during the time of the Olympic Games, but we will get to that in a bit as well.
And I want to just say something quickly about the priestess of Demeter. I didn't go too deep down a rabbit hole here because this is such a long episode, but she was the only woman who was allowed to be present. She kind of had like a vestal virgin status. I don't know that she was a virgin, but that's kind of how they treated her, like she was presiding over the games. There were sacrifices done to Demeter. Demeter was very much also worshipped here. Again, going back to that idea, Jenny, of there was originally a cult to a female goddess who was taken over by Zeus.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. Like maybe this centering of Demeter was like the last sort of vestigial limb of that.
That's what I think.
I don't know that there's scholarship backing this up, but that's what it feels like to me.
Wild conjecture. Again, if you want to use that in your papers, make sure it's true first. Don't quote us as a source.
Do not quote us as a source in your thesis. Anyway, so the Olympic Games were very much tied to mythology. They were deeply connected with the myth of Anemeus, Pelops, and Hippodamia. If the name Pelops sounds familiar, that's because it is. Pelops eventually gives his name to the Peloponnese, the mountainous region where Olympia is located. Anyway, this myth is about a father, Anemeus, who was so in love with his daughter Hippodamia, ew! Incest is best! That he challenged all of her prospective suitors to a chariot race from Corinth to Olympia.
Now, we're going to talk about this in a Patreon because I'm going to tell you all of these myths around Olympus because of course I am. I just want to throw this in here. Pelops, Jenny, was a lover of Poseidon.
If you want all the steamy details, join our Patreon because we're going to do a video about it. Anyway, we're just giving you the thumbnail version here. Eventually, he meets his match with Pelops, who I guess beats him at the chariot race, right?
He does. He uses some trickery and he beats him.
Right. So Pelops is a suitor of Hippodamia and does some trickery and kills the father and wins through trickery. The games, Bettany Hughes suggests, might have begun as funeral games for Anemeus. Or Bettany Hughes suggests they might have gone all the way back to the Titanomachy when Zeus defeated his father Cronos. According to the myths, Zeus defeated Cronos on a hill, the hill of Cronos that is still inside the site of Olympia. It's on this hill that allegedly the first games were played. Spoiler, Apollo won most of the games. Apollo was a total show-off. He won most of the games. Everybody eye-rolled. And it's this epic history or backstory that made Olympia famous long before mortals began hosting games to honor Zeus, the fuck daddy. You can still visit the Hill of Cronos today. The hill overlooks the entire ancient site and gives a great view of the sanctuary below it. In ancient times, you would climb up here and be able to look down at a sprawling collection of 760 buildings, including temples to Zeus, Hera, and many other gods. Workshops, sanctuaries, and the epic Pelopion, the tomb to the ancient mythical chariot racing king, proving maybe he wasn't entirely mythical, maybe this story was built on some existing person, We don't know, and probably this story had been mythologized beyond all recognition by the time it was recorded. There are also ties to Heracles and Hades at Olympia, but we're going to save all this mythology for a Patreon episode because it's fun and wild and a little bit of a digression at the moment. We just know that it all exists, and it's all really complicated.
It's all really fun, and you know I'm going to have some drinks and tell you all the dirt. So, what was it like at Olympia? What were the ancient games like to attend? Well, kind of gross, really smelly, sticky, so much olive oil, hot, all the poop, and so many animals. Because there's humans and animals all together. So much poop.
I guess that would have been true for most of the ancient world, right?
Yeah, there wasn't great sanitation here. That's why. But we'll get there.
High numbers of people and animals crowded into a small space.
Exactly. And there were so many dudes. So many naked, oily dudes. It was a lot. It was a feast for the eyes, shall we say.
They all competed naked, right? So they were all just naked and oiled up.
When I was reading Bettany Hughes' book, I don't know if I've mentioned it later, one of the things that Bettany Hughes said was one of the biggest causes of, like, people, like, becoming ill or, like, needing medical care was heat exhaustion from being a spectator watching the games. It wasn't the athletes. It was just people watching it and just being exhausted from the heat because the games were also held in the summer high in the mountains.
And they probably just went for hours, right? Like, they had such an attention span back then. I remember reading about the gladiatorial games and it's like hours and hours and hours. And then there's like this halftime show of people getting killed and like eaten by wild beasts and stuff. And then more hours and hours of just sitting on like a stone bench and watching this stuff. They didn't have phones, okay? The attention spans were wildly different.
It wasn't just sitting. There were sellers. There were people selling food and goods and wares and also sex. So, like, there was other stuff happening. It wasn't just the sporting. And also, this is a place to see and be seen. So, I'm going to try and keep this as brief as possible here because even though this is a series about the seven wonders of the ancient world, I talked to Jenny and we have decided that we're going to do an episode in the style of A Day at the Gladiatorial Games or Could You Survive Pompeii, all about the Olympics. I think I might save it for the Olympics this summer. We'll see. It's going to start with the first sacrifice to the naked training, going through the afternoon delights and all the other wild things that happen. And don't worry, I'm going to share all that dirt. Just not in this episode, although you'll get a little in this episode, a teaser, if you will.
The Olympic Games were so dirty. I just want, and there's so many fluids everywhere. And we mean that literally and dirty, if you know what I mean. So the Olympic Games happened every 4 years. While Greek men, both spectators and athletes, made their way to the sanctuary at Olympia, they had to follow certain protocols in order to compete. This included a stop at the nearby town of Elis, a place made famous by Heracles and his labors. Apparently, this is the one where he had to clean out the stinky stables of the man-eating horses, the mares of Thrace, an impossible feat. Unless you can divert a river, that is.
Exactly. Unless you can divert a river. That's how stinky it was. And it's kind of important to remember that because we're going to talk about how stinky it was in Olympia when the games were on. And part of that is because of the sanitation, because they couldn't divert a river.
We're going to really dwell on that.
I don't know why I'm dwelling on it so much, but apparently that's my jam.
No, are you kidding me? That's my favorite part. I'm like, oh, tell me about all the poop everywhere.
All the poop and all the flies and mosquitoes.
And the sperm and the seminal fluid and ugh. Anyway, so this location is also not far from where Heracles killed the Erymanthian boar in mythology, theoretically. It's said that at Elis, Heracles taught men how to wrestle, and I bet he did.
He did like to wrestle.
Famously bisexual. A huge dinosaur bone was found in this region, a dinosaur bone that the ancient Greeks believed belonged to Heracles, and the bone was displayed at Olympia in the sanctuary as having been one of Heracles' bones.
I just love that. You know, if I was in the ancient world, I'd be like, please take my picture next to Heracles' bone. Please, please.
Right, this is a shin bone or something. It's like taller than you.
No, it's Heracles, but also a T-Rex. It's fine. It's two of my favorite things.
Maybe Heracles was a T-Rex. Think about it.
That would explain so many of his actions.
Think about it, you guys. Anyway, back to these protocols that you needed to do at Elis in order to compete in the games. Preparation and training began about 10 months before the games. This is a commitment. A lot was needed to make the site ready for the huge influx of people who would be arriving to take part in the games. So if you were an athlete, you had to get there 10 months beforehand?
I think some of it is not about the athletes getting there 10 months beforehand. I think it's the crew of people who needed to, like, make the site ready.
Support staff, basically.
Yes, there was a huge support staff that had to, like, work to make sure that, again, these games were considered a religious experience. So there was religious stuff that had to be done. There was rituals that had to be conducted at certain times by certain people to ensure that, like, the game properly honored their god and also was fair and was set up well and all that kind of stuff.
So Bettany Hughes in Seven Wonders of the Ancient World tells us all about the work that went on to prepare for the games. Quote, "It was at Elis that hardcore training for the games took place over 40 days and nights, all presided over by the original Olympic Committee, 9 Elian elders, the Hellanodikai, or judges of the Greeks. What went on in Elis gives us a sense of how carefully laden with ceremony and import this ritual of might and main, of ascendance, was. The Hellanodikai, I'm sure I'm butchering that pronunciation, here were chosen by lot from within the oligarchy, their names scratched onto ostraca, broken pottery sherds. Theirs was a serious task. Planning, overseeing athletes training in Elis, themselves training for 10 months to do so, officiating at religious ceremonies in the sanctuary, the Hellanodikai kept the games legal, clean, and sacred. They dressed in purple robes to mark out their kingly status. Once the games started, they would preside as judges and award prizes, sitting opposite the only woman officially allowed to witness the contests, the high priestess of Demeter, who watched enthroned above an altar, the very marble blocks of which, rebuilt in the 2nd century AD, are still in situ at the Olympic Stadium, a prototype venue which would be copied across the Greek world."
We can go see it.
I would love to do that.
I wanted to include all of that quote because it really gives you an idea, like Jenny and I were saying, like, there is this high priestess of Demeter. She's the only woman who's officially allowed to witness these contests. But why? Why Demeter? It's such an odd flex, you know what I mean? You would imagine it'd be Hera. It would be Zeus's wife.
And originally there was a temple to Hera here, right?
There was one to Hera, and there is a temple to Demeter there as well. Obviously, there would have to be. So it's really fascinating, this strange holdover of far more ancient worship. And they sort of like put her away from the crowd. Like she's not, God, can you imagine how bored she would have been?
I mean, she's not allowed to bone any of the men. No sex, no oiling, no other women. It's stinky. I don't know that this is a job I would necessarily want to, maybe one time. I would do it like one time and then I'd be like, okay, that's enough. I saw one games.
That's not how being a priestess works, Jenny.
You mean I'm not in control of my whole life?
You are not. Strangely, that is not how giving your life over to the devotion and worship of a goddess works.
I just give one summer over.
I think there's someone who's been training her whole life for it, and they're going to pick her over you.
That is fair. I mean.
So, with the stage set, the Olympic Games were able to proceed. And make no mistake, these games were both about male beauty, I hate that word, power and prowess, but they were also an act of religious worship. These were a religious event, and making it onto the field as a competitor was an act of devotion and worship to Zeus. When the athletes left Elis, which was about 23 miles away from Olympia, they traveled through the woods. Like, archaeologists have found different pop-up altars and places of worship along this road between these two places, showing where people laid offerings and devotions in ancient times. The woods were packed with wild animals, including wild boars, birds, deer, and of course, Zeus's favorite, eagles. Eagles were a symbol of Zeus, and they would have been plentiful on this route to Olympia, making pilgrims feel all that deeper a connection to their beloved sky god.
And when they arrived at Olympia, that was when the wild times began. That was when the fun started. Pele, Hawaiian goddess of volcanoes, fire, and rebirth.
Maeve, Celtic warrior queen and nemesis of heroes.
Kiyohime, Japanese fire-breathing snake demon.
Pesta, Norwegian spirit of the Black Death. Our book, Women of Myth, is a fascinating look at women and femme characters in world mythology, including goddesses, heroines, and monsters. With captivating illustrations by Ringo Award-nominated artist Sarah Richard, it's the perfect gift for the mythology lover in your life, including yourself.
Find Women of Myth wherever books are sold.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
From 456 BC, the temple that housed the statue of Zeus at Olympia would have dominated everything. But before that, the site would have looked radically different. Kind of apologetic, as the temples and worship complexes here were much more humble. This is previously to the statue of Zeus, right?
This is before the temple was built. So the temple was built and then the statue was built. So pre sort of like 436 when the temple was built and then the statue eventually gets in there, it was quite a humble site. There were temples, but they weren't very big or grand. They were much more ancient. They were simple places of worship before this.
Okay, so just to get a sense of the chronology, from like the 700s BC when the game started up until just prior to when the Temple of Zeus at Olympia was built, and then the statue would have been added a few decades later, right?
Yeah, I think the statue only took like 17 years, but I could be wrong, to add in. Yeah, it came in after the temple. There were temples there. They just weren't these grand temples like we're going to see when the Temple of Zeus at Olympia is built. They were more modest, more in keeping with sort of like being up in the middle of the mountains.
Right. So, okay. So I'm going to describe to you what it looked like before the Temple of Zeus at Olympia arrived and Phidias just redid everything.
Yeah. And I wanted this here because the poop.
Bettany Hughes is a very vivid description of this.
She does. And I was like, I cannot do this any better than she did. So everyone who's listening, go buy the book on the Seven Wonders. It's incredible. But get ready.
Okay. So anyway, I'm going to describe what the original Olympic Village looked like pre-Zeus Temple. Quote, "If Elis was the Olympic Village, Olympia was a pilgrim's destination, a monastic complex cum mosh pit."
Come,
mosh pit. "The central sacred space here was originally called simply Altis, the grove, an area still soft with wild olive and oak and poplar and plane trees, fertile from the waters where the river Alpheos meets its tributary, the Cladios. The Altis has a unique and animistic feel. The ground here is moist and mossy. Mosquitoes sneak onto your skin at the wrong time of day." I mean, when is the right time of day for mosquitoes? Am I right? Question mark. I don't know why I said that dirty. It's just a totally non-dirty fact. Zeus, the god of the sky and of the waters that came from the sky to feed the earth, would have approved of the dewy fertility here. Sexy. From numerous classical sources, we hear there was an ancient olive tree from which the victorious athletes' wreaths were cut, quite possibly itself an object of worship in a time before history. As pilgrims began to head down into the valley, they would have heard the birdsong from Olympia's woods, and then they would have felt the flies on their faces. Oh, and then they would have smelled the odor of shit. This was the excreta of mass crowds, anywhere between 50,000 and 100,000 together in a space that feels busy when just 5,000 visitors come today. Greeks and their households drawn together from tiny islands and major cities from all points of the compass, mainly men, eating, drinking, making love, working out, dragging in reluctant animal after animal, from doves to rams to goats to bulls, all to be sacrificed.
So yeah, Jenny, it was a sweaty, stinky, bloody, poopy mess. Imagine all these men, complete with their households, enslaved people, sex workers, gathering in a very small space with no sanitation. The sanitation here was terrible. There were so many animals, both for sacrifice and just in general eating while they're there for the games, and they just kind of took over. They turned this small hamlet in the mountains into their own orgy, because there were orgies, and we'll get there. It would have stunk all the way to Mount Olympus. Those poor rivers would not have been enough. And we know that it was bad there, like the smells and the flies and everything else, because one of Zeus's names that was like found at the site, Bettany Hughes tells us, is Zeus, the averter of flies, because people prayed to him to keep the flies off of them and their livestock. So in this stinking, fly-infested sanctuary, you would make your oath to Zeus, swearing at the feet of a statue that allegedly was built on the ground where a lightning bolt struck the earth, making it doubly sacred and also an opportunity for priests to fleece the people.
This is pre-Phidias' statue, right?
Yes, Phidias' statue has not come yet, or not existed yet. That was the wrong way to phrase it in this episode.
I was just like, oh man, this site is already really sticky. And the statue of Zeus at Olympia is the stickiest of the statues, but we'll get there.
It really is, but we're not there yet. There were many, many statues to Zeus in the sanctuary, including this very famous one of him holding a lightning bolt in his hand. There were rows of bronze statues of Zeus going down a line. And they were overwhelming, and they were designed to let everyone know who is in charge here. Zeus. These statues sometimes had the names of different winners of Olympics carved on them. It was like a privilege that you got to erect a statue of Zeus here. Everything here was Zeus. It was Zeus central. It was really a testament to the male ego.
It really was. It's an act of domination and colonization of the feminine force. That's what it is.
So anyway, setting all the rows of bronze Zeus statues aside, pilgrims made their way to the temple when it existed and swore their Olympic oaths. Before that, well, they did it by the lightning bolt statue. And then, Jenny, well, the festivities began. So, it is now time to talk about the orgies. I know, Jenny, I have been teasing this for so long, and you're thrilled that we've gotten to this part at last.
God, finally, we finally are talking about the orgies. That's what I came here for. That's why I'm in this stinky place.
Again, the only person who I've seen talk about the orgies in any depth is Bettany Hughes, so we're going to quote from her again. Before we get there, you have to set the stage. Athletes would arrive, they'd go and they'd get purified and anointed with oil and everything else, and they would get naked, and they would exercise naked in the gymnasium.
All those rippling muscles.
These naked exercise sessions were a chance for the men to size up their competitors' talent. And the local talent, because this was also where men went to, well, meet up and get it on.
It was a hookup site. They were not there for the ladies. Well, I guess there were sex workers there too, so I don't know.
There were. There were sex workers who were there who were both male and female.
So this is a quote from Bettany Hughes' Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. Again, we're quoting from Bettany Hughes, you guys go buy her book, that talks about the orgies. Quote, here, typically couples would hang out to watch one another. There are numerous accounts of men exercising all morning and making love all afternoon. A swimming pool accessed by steps at either end was eventually provided to allow the athletes to cool off and wash because they were stinky, they were sweaty, they were oily, and it was hot there. People were dying of heat stroke.
It was so hot, but I'm also like, how gross would that pool be?
It would be really gross because if you think about like the descriptions of the ancient Roman baths and how they were just like there was this scrim of like poo and bodily fluids. Ugh.
That water probably wasn't even cold. It was like bath water. It was not great.
Anyway, so I'm going to go on with this quote. Quote, much beautiful flesh would have been on show in the gymnasium. There were laws to prevent loitering and pandering. The sweat, oil, and dust of the competitors was literally bottled and sold as a quack potion called gloios.
That is like what they did with the gladiators, the sweat, oil, and everything else. Like it goes all the way back here to the beginnings of the Olympics that they were like, all of this stuff is like a magic potion from these exceptional men.
Yeah, absolutely. There were rub downs with sea sponges soaked in olive oil. The rites for Zeus seem to have been all about being uber macho. I'm going on with this quote. In the true Greek sense of the word, all about fighting, about male achievement, overachievement, and male love, overlove of all kinds. A kind of eroticized ambition with a capital E. Because the Greek godlet Eros, consort son of the goddess of sexual love, Aphrodite, was thought to inspire desire, yearning, ravening of all kinds, including worsting and beating others, proving your prowess, proving you could win. And I'm just going to add this. This isn't her. It's me. Domination. So this is how the athletes prepared and spent their days. They also took a lot of time to curse and hex their competition. We know because we found the evidence.
Oh, yeah. We found the evidence. We found the curse tablets. They might not have been tablets, but they were things that had curses inscribed on them.
And it was allowed. Cursing and hexing your opponents wasn't considered cheating. However, bribing the judge or other forms of cheating was considered shameful. Shame!
Shame!
Those who engaged in this kind of activity were humiliated. They were considered disgraceful, fined, and their names were recorded on statues of Zeus on display as being cheaters. Harsh. But also fair.
Those statues of Zeus were called Zanes. I just thought I'd tell you that.
Cool. And they were covered with names. Names of winners and cheaters.
The Zanes were only for the cheaters. That's what Bettany Hughes tells us. So, there you have it. The orgies, the curse tablets, and there were all the Zeuses, just all the Zeuses, and Zanes, who are also Zeuses.
Because there were lots of cheaters, let's be clear.
So many cheaters. In addition to the athletic events, there were also other games, including singing contests, philosophy face-offs, poetry slams. And these events provided entertainment for the spectators, in between the athletic feats, and they could be participated in only by men, by Greek citizens again. Although I don't think in this instance there was such an emphasis on male beauty to compete in these events, so presumably anyone of any age or body could compete. And during this very festival-like atmosphere, male and female sex workers worked the crowd. They served drinks and sold their wares. It was a wild time. And before we finally move into describing the statue and the temple that housed it, I know you're so excited. I wanted to touch on just a few more things about the Olympics. First, as Bettany Hughes mentions in her book, the Olympics were all about male virility. These were manly games where men showed off their perfect bodies, in quotation marks, and competed in epic feats of sport and strength. Women were not invited. But we know that women were at these games, maybe not in attendance watching from the crowd, but there is evidence of female sex workers being in Olympia during the games. Greek women were not permitted to be present during the games on penalty of death. Women who snuck into these games were to be thrown from a high cliff. And that also has a mythological origin story about Artemis, and I'll discuss that on the Patreon. Were non-Greek women allowed? Did the sex workers have to be non-Greek? Well, we don't actually know the answers to those questions. It's probable that the sex workers were enslaved and therefore wouldn't have been considered Greek to begin with.
They might have been foreign sex slaves taken in war, or this is all very unclear. I really don't know.
It's all unclear, and I don't think there is any evidence that says one way or another.
Maybe there wasn't a concept of Greek back then, as in everybody was Greek, you know, but there was a concept of like a Hellenic shared culture. And are we talking about the Hellenic shared culture, or are we talking about citizenship, which would have been a different thing? And enslaved people were not citizens.
Women weren't citizens either. So I don't know the answer. Were women who were sex workers allowed to be present and seeing the competition because they were sex workers and naked men were nothing to them, as opposed to women who were married or unmarried?
Whose chastity needed to be protected, or virtue or whatever. Yeah.
At all costs. Exactly.
But they would have been like at Ellis and like amongst the support staff and probably making themselves available.
And they might have been in the stadiums performing sex acts, unfortunately. We don't know. Or serving men. But again, I can't say for sure, like serving men food and drink. I can't say for sure whether that's true or not.
So according to ancient Olympic arts, quote, women were not allowed as spectators at the Olympic Games. They had to stay at the other side of the river Alpheios during the games. The only woman to attend the games was the priestess of Demeter. A law stipulated that every other female spectator had to be thrown off a high cliff. Did the sex workers count as spectators? We could debate that endlessly. Probably not, but I'm just guessing there. For other games, such laws are not known. It is, however, probable that women were also not allowed as spectators of other athletic contests. The Roman Emperor Augustus enacted a law that women were allowed in the theater only after the fifth hour, because before the fifth hour, athletic contest took place there.
What it's telling us is that they did all of the sports, like the real physical activities, early in the day.
Yeah, and they didn't want women to see all those oily, manly men.
All those oily, naked, manly men. And look at the old dude they've been married to by their father and be like...
They might be tempted to choose who they have sex with for once. Good Lord, no, we can't have that. We can't have women having consensual sex. No.
There is no female agency allowed.
I'm continuing the quote here. Only once a woman was caught at Olympia. She was one of the daughters of Diagoras of Rhodes. The sources do not agree if it was Phrynike or Kallipatera. The head of a family of successful athletes. Disguised as a trainer, she brought her son to the games after the death of her husband. When he won the boxing contest, in her joy, she jumped over the fence, which separated the trainers from the athletes, and lost her clothes. Okay. Whoops, my clothes just fell right off. Oops.
No, I disagree with you. So many of those clothes were held together with like a pin. These were easy on and off clothes. I can seriously see that happening.
Ancient Greece, like a lot of the time, it was like you either wear a tunic that comes up to mid-thigh so you're flashing everybody, or you're maybe wearing a giant piece of cloth that's held on your body with like one pin. Or like some elaborate folding situation. There's no pins. It's just very elaborately folded. And you're supposed to keep that one drape over your arm and your arm held at one angle the whole time, which I think is the toga.
I think that's a toga which a woman wouldn't be wearing.
Sex workers wore togas. Did you know that? In ancient Rome. They wore scarlet togas.
I did not know that. Hot. But yeah, I do think like I can totally... Knowing what I know, like particularly even just going back to our series on Boudica and... The fights there, like one of the most common things that archaeologists find when large groups of people gather together is like brooches and pins, because those were used to keep clothes together and they easily fell off. So they got stomped a lot and lost. And that's why we find them down through the ages. And I find it fascinating.
So there's just so many people in the ancient world having wardrobe malfunctions. That's why women were kept inside all the time, because their clothes might just fall off. So anyway, it became apparent that she was a woman, but out of respect for her father, brothers, and son, all Olympic winners, she was not punished.
In general, the role of women at the Olympic Games in Olympia was to be absent, unless they were sex workers or one priestess, one lone priestess. That's not to say women weren't represented at Olympia. They were. There were huge temples, and I'm talking about Olympia, not in the Olympics, about the actual complex. There were huge temples dedicated to several goddesses, including Demeter and Hera and Artemis and Athena. And the priestess of Demeter presided over the entire Olympics and many things that happened at Olympia. And as we've said before, Olympia had once been a sanctuary to a divine feminine goddess. But this changed over the millennia, and the area became sacred to Zeus and, unfortunately, all things male. Hey, it's Jen and Jenny here to tell you about our new favorite podcast, For the Love of History.
Nobody really doesn't love history. They just haven't found the right teacher yet. Or, in this case, a nerdy BFF who loves to tell you all about world history, women's history, and weird history. Created by history lover and entertainer TK, For the Love of History is a podcast for people who want to learn more but don't know where to start, and history lovers who want a break from mainstream topics. From rat trials to emperor's baddies to lady samurai, TK covers topics from every country and era. Whether you're a history expert or just starting, there's a place for you in the time machine.
For the Love of History covers a variety of topics, from silly to serious, and everything in between. You don't have to be a history expert to enjoy every episode. And listening to TK is like listening to a friend, a very entertaining and nerdy friend filling you in on their latest history obsession. Sounds like us, Denny.
I love friends like that.
Me too. So join TK every Friday while you commute, decompress, do your laundry, or whatever.
Find For the Love of History wherever you get your podcasts.
So, while women were forbidden from watching or competing at the Olympic Games at Olympia, that is not to say they didn't have their own games. Again, these games are also steeped in mythology. These games were called the Heraean Games, and they also took place once every 4 years, and they were held in Hera's honor. And I'll talk more about that on our Patreon, but women did have their own games that only women were allowed to compete in. I haven't gone into the details yet about whether men could spectate, but I don't think so, because I also think women ran in not a lot of clothing.
I'm so curious about the Heraean Games, because this is actually the first I've heard about that. Did they take place at the same place?
They took place at Olympia in the same stadium. As far as I can tell, they took place at Olympia. They were also held every 4 years. I don't know who was able to attend and who wasn't yet, but they were women who competed in these games. I suspect it was other women who were able to attend, but we'll know more. So the final point that I wanted to make about the Olympic Games, again, comes from Bettany Hughes's book, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. She talks about how, while these games might have been a testament to male fitness, there is also evidence that many people who came to witness these games would have been people of all abilities. There are ramps and other things that suggest that spectators who were differently abled were able to watch the games and take part as both spectators and as worshippers. So for now, we're going to leave the games and finally talk about the statue itself. We've set all those scenes.
Right. So now that you know about where the statue was and the significance of that, let's talk about this incredible statue, the statue of Zeus at Olympia and the man who sculpted it. As we mentioned earlier, Phidias was kind of persona non grata at Athens, despite his amazing work on the Parthenon. After finishing up his work at the Parthenon, Phidias found himself in need of a new job because he had been at the center of all these accusations in Athens after doing this incredible work. Did he steal all that gold? Did he deliberately carve his own face on that shield? Is he guilty of hubris? Suddenly, he needed to get the fuck out of Athens before he wound up in even more trouble. So, Phidias took a position building a statue for the Backwater Sanctuary at Olympia, which at the time was a humble temple complex. I mean, this is beneath him. Phidias was just coming off of constructing these extremely prominent, extremely famous statues of Athena. And now he's all the way back there at Olympia with the piles of animal poo and the humble, humble statuary.
I guess it's like going from winning an Oscar and then deciding the next thing you're going to do is a Lifetime movie. Now listen, I love me a Lifetime movie or a terrible Hallmark Christmas movie, but it kind of feels like a little bit backwards after you've like won this huge award to do that, unless you're Ian McKellen and you just have a rock star career. But anyway, moving on.
So Phidias strolled into the humble temple complex with its piles of animal poop everywhere and all the flies, and he looked around and he had big plans. He was going to give this place a glow up. He was going to create a statue unlike anything the ancient world had ever seen. It would be his life's work. He was going to tell all those jerks in Athens, fuck you, you wish you'd kept me around, because look at my statue, it's even better than your statue. So there.
Exactly. And I want to be very clear, he didn't build the temple. He had some input in it, but he wasn't the architect of the temple, just the statue inside.
Question, did the temple exist before he got there, or did they build the temple for the statue?
I'm not sure of the answer here. I think that the temple that the statue is put in came probably around the same time he did, maybe a little bit before. It might have existed before, and then he added the statue into it. But I don't actually know the answer to that question, and I don't think anything satisfactorily gave me the answer to that question.
Anyway, so this is what Bettany Hughes tells us about the temple and the site of Olympia during Phidias' tenure as master craftsperson there. Okay, so I actually really love this part. This is possibly my favorite part. Can we just talk about what we're talking about here? Because is this the site of the temple?
So the site of the temple and where they used to have like the altar where they would make their worship. Originally, it was just this mound, right? This just mound where they would just like sacrifice an animal and it would just all like all the crap, which is just blood and everything else, just go everywhere, right? And this mound, this sacred mound, was actually closer to the ancient temple of Hera, and they moved it over just a little bit towards Zeus, but it wasn't like a full-on temple. It was just kind of a mound.
So they didn't have a temple until, I'm trying to figure out, like, what the timeline of this temple is, and it sounds like the dates are, like, this is actually really fuzzy. Like,
all of this is very fuzzy. I'm not sure what it looked like sort of pre the Temple of Olympian season. I'm not sure anybody exactly knows. We do know at one point there were 760 buildings in this complex. It's possible original things might have been built of different materials that didn't last, but we know this mound has always been there.
So this mound is possibly the most sacred site in the complex before they built this temple. And they built the temple to replace the mound.
I think they still sacrifice stuff in the mound as well, but...
Okay, so they didn't replace the mound. The mound continued. I'm trying to understand the significance of this mound. But let me just read you this paragraph from Bettany Hughes that Jenna included. Bettany Hughes has a lot to say about the sacrificial mound.
I know, and it's so great.
So this is kind of what Phidias saw when he strolled into this humble complex. Like, he looked at this and he's like, oh man, this place super needs a glow up. Bettany Hughes says, quote, "Dark, muddy, gelatinous, with bone and fat, and held together as a kind of ash cement when mixed with water from the Alpheios River, the original Zeus mound was a reminder of the prehistoric roots of Greek religion. Over 6,000 offerings, figurines of the warrior god Zeus, mortal warriors, chariots and charioteers, as well as images of bulls and horses, have all been retrieved from the remains of this pile of bone and ash. Analysis of the remains shows there was continuous combustion from the late 11th to the early 6th century BC when the altar was shifted a little, but the sacrificial mound was never decommissioned. The accretions of old sacrifice, bone, fat, and skin, here were so solid, a stairway could be carved into them. From around 700 BC, the offerings ardently donated were personal possessions, including bronze tripods which would have supported massive cauldrons." Good Lord.
Isn't that incredible what they found?
Yeah, it seems like it would have been possibly not active in that time because it seems like it ended in the early 6th century. So that would have been like the 500s BC.
This is about when they were moving it over. But it says it was never officially decommissioned.
I'm just so interested in like this timeline. Like, when were they using this mound? When did they start using like a fancy, nice temple? Like, what is happening right now?
There's a lot of work that they're still doing on this site. So there's things like, in Bettany Hughes' book, she's like, as of 2022, I can tell you this. So there is still work being done there, and we don't have all of the answers yet, which I know is always frustrating for Jenny and me. I mean, I'm a little more like, I don't know, but Jenny's like, I want to know, which is why our personalities work so well, because I'll let it go, and Jenny will be like, keep digging, and then my hyperfocus will kick in, and I will spend 3 days finding the answer, if there is one. But yeah, so I don't exactly know the answers here. It seems like they were doing stuff here, and maybe it moved. So, I wanted to include all of those details about the original Zeus mound because I was floored, like my jaw just dropped. There was just this mound of slaughtered remains of various animals mixed with mud and ash and other organic materials going back to prehistoric times. That was the earliest monument to Zeus, but was it Zeus or was it a different goddess? We don't know.
Going all the way back to the 1100s BC?
Yeah, because that space hadn't always been sacred to Zeus. So originally, that mound of jelly, bone, and ash was potentially dedicated to Hera, maybe.
Just what I wanted for my birthday. A mound of jellied bone and ash.
Worship of Zeus came along later, as we've said. Anyway, this mound, this place, was what Phidias wanted to glow up. And so the new temple that was built was inspired by the design of the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which is fascinating because that is definitely a temple designed to the female space. The temple was going to be built to contain the statue of Olympian Zeus, and it was absolutely incredible to behold. First, the temple was in color. There was so much color. It was a riot of color.
So you mean the temple or the statue or both?
We know that the statue was blinged out. He was covered in gold plating and jewels and precious stones because, listen, Phidias had to make his money somehow, skimming off the top. Anyway, we don't know he did that, but, you know.
I'm not judging your spreadsheet. I'm not judging your gold embezzlement.
So we know that the statue itself was ivory over bronze, and the ivory had been specially tempered to make it seem lifelike. I also think the temple, at least on the outside, had some color to it. I mean, that's what I seem to read in Bettany Hughes' book, but I could be wrong. I don't think we exactly know.
Well, a lot of those monuments, you know, those temples and statues were very colorfully painted. Like, we have this image of the time as being just all white statues, and that's not the case. Like, they painted everything.
That's what I think. I think they painted the marble and it would have stayed painted for a long time. And we're going to talk about like what that would have looked like. It's super important to remember that like we think of it as being very white and austere and, you know, very like staid. But they really worked with these materials to make them seem lifelike. And things like lions or chimeras or Amazons all had colors and depth to them.
Absolutely. So the temple was made from the finest Parian marble, which was the same marble used at the Temple of Ephesus. And I believe, if I remember right, Parian marble is famously white, but would have been painted, potentially.
Yes, I believe the outside of the temple would, but not the roof.
So just like the Temple of Ephesus, it was raised up on a platform about 10 feet high, and the roof had 100 lion heads carved on it that spouted water during the rainy season. You can still see some of the lion heads abandoned in the tall grass at the archaeological site. Oh my gosh, I want to go there and find the lion heads.
Me too. I just want to go and see them. 100 lion heads all acted as water spouts. So the water would come off them like guttering and then down the temple sides.
There's a waterfall coming off of the temple. The roof tiles were marble, but cut so finely that they were almost like glass. This meant that the light inside the temple was smooth and, I guess, like, milky, you know? It would have had this very trippy, ethereal quality. So, like, was the roof, like, transparent? Is that what you're saying?
They were cut so fine that it was almost like glass, but it wasn't glass. And because of the coloring of the Parian marble, which I don't think they painted over, the light had this very strange quality to it. It was very, like, a smooth and almost like a rich, milky sort of quality to it. It was like a warm kind of otherworldly glow. And that's super important when you have a giant statue inside a temple and you're trying to like make a statement. Essentially what they were doing at this point in time was using light gels, which like we do now in theater and stuff, but that's what they were doing with this Parian marble.
Light gels?
Yeah, you know, like if you have like a spotlight or different lights in theater, you'll put like a colored gel over it and it'll change the effect of how the scene looks. That's what they did with the Parian marble. They cut it really finely so that it had this richness, because that marble is very rich and it's very white.
And it's transparent, so the light's coming through the roof.
Coming through is this very rich white light. It's not a harsh light. It's very filtered.
So anyway, so there would have been this very trippy and ethereal quality to this light. Like they were creating a vibe that was different than the outside, which is something, you know, like that's how they created a sacred space, right? Like the temple was the sacred space, so the light's different. This is why a lot of sacred spaces in the ancient world had incense. The smells would be different.
But again, like if you think about these different sacred spaces, like I don't know, I haven't done an episode on the Parthenon or the Pantheon in Rome, which has that incredible skylight, essentially. Part of what you're trying to get here with Zeus being the all father, the sky god, is this real feeling of oppressive, rich light that's sort of making this statue look as if it could rise from its throne and smote you. It's so cool.
You mean smite?
Smote? Smitten?
That's past tense.
He could rise. I mean, he's not there now. He could rise from his throne and smite you.
Smoten?
Smoten? Smoteed?
Anyway, so I'm continuing to describe this temple. The outer colonnade had 6 columns on the front and back and 13 around the sides. It was the biggest building in the Peloponnese. It was almost the biggest building in all of mainland Greece, but those pesky, petty-ass Athenians found out about the dimensions of this building and extended the Parthenon ever so slightly to deliberately best the temple. Rude.
They're so rude.
So we're going to quote once again from Bettany Hughes because we seriously cannot stop quoting from Bettany Hughes.
And also because I have not seen this description anywhere else, no matter how far I looked for it, and I wanted to give credit to the person who described it.
Quote, on the east pediment of this doggedly muscular Doric construction was a vigorous scene of that homicidal chariot race between Pelops and Onomaeus, overseen by Zeus and anxious-looking seers. On the west pediment, with rational Apollo surveying, was the battle between Lapiths and Centaurs in Thessaly, the Centaurs abusing Lapith women and attempting to rape them. Oh, God. Greek heroes in the furious fray are being bitten and kicked. Attacks on Amazons were also celebrated above the temple doors. The labors, or rather contests, from the Greek word athloi, which gives us our word athletes today, of Heracles hectically decorated either end of inside the porches. The appetitive hero Theseus was immortalized too. So I feel like this is kind of a monument to violence against women.
Yes. And that's also why I included this. Because it really is quite violent against women. And it really is showing you something about what the Greeks were valuing here in this temple this dominance of male over female over and over again. And in the sense of the Lapith women, it's like men coming to the aid of women if they are being sort of violated, right? Because women can't rescue themselves. Like, the Amazons have to be beaten down. Theseus has to be celebrated. Fuck that dude. And Heracles, oh, poor Heracles. But he's also the reason they have these games.
That's really the message that I'm seeing. Like, this is a monument to violence against women, and it's a monument to infantilizing women and making them dependent on men for their safety. That's what we're seeing here. And like I said, like I've been saying this whole time, like, what are they on top of? What are they trying to oppress and stamp down? Because there must have been a powerful female sacredness here that existed long before this happened. Something changed in the 770s BC or whenever that we don't know about because it wasn't written down.
Yeah, and I think it was later than that. I think like the 700s was when the game started. But this codification of male violence over women and taking over this sacred feminine space in such a demonstrative way really came with these big temples that were built in the 400s. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about Pericles and the Delian League and what was going on at that time period. Now, inside the temple, Jenny, there were huge painted panels that essentially praised the athletes and heroes and, in general, just the spirit of competition. Bethany Hughes says these panels were kind of like ancient world billboards advertising the best of the best. But to me, they remind me of, I've said this many times, I was a competitive swimmer. And at our swimming pool or even in some people's high school gyms, you'll sometimes have like signs or you'll have pennants that come down like banners that'll show the records of the star athletes. And this is pretty much the ancient world version of that. And for almost 20 years, this temple was built 20 years before the statue. The temple had only these banners. The statue hadn't been constructed yet. These banners just decorated an empty temple, waiting for the god to descend and take his place on his throne. Now, Zeus's temple was all about the manliness. It was about celebrating quote-unquote heroes and their quote-unquote deeds. Make of that what you will. You know how I feel about Theseus and Jason and so many others. And this made it a direct opposite to the temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which was allegedly all about the feminine energy. I haven't done the full deep dive. That's what Bethany Hughes tells me. I trust her, and we will get there. I'm so excited for that. Reading about this temple, I'm like, all I want to do is live in Ephesus now, but I have other things to do.
All we want to do is flee Olympia and live at Ephesus. Yes. I wonder why. So now let's talk about the statue itself, right? It took like 20 years to complete. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
So this statue, once it was completed, was like nothing anyone had ever seen before. It was huge. It was about 40 feet tall. It was as tall as a 3-story building carved sitting on a throne. Ancient sources say that even sitting, Zeus's head almost brushed the ceiling of the temple. He looked like if he stood up, he would crack open the walls of his own temple and spill out into the cosmos. Like, this is a very common description.
Can you imagine being the person who's like, oh, this is the temple you built for me. Right, now I'm going to build a statue that's so big, it looks like it's going to destroy your temple. We cool?
It is kind of a flex. Like, I'm going to build this statue sitting. Like, wow. And I'm going to take up all the space. With this soft and milky light, just glowy light, reflecting off of the brightly painted ivory statue, the effect would have been terrifying. The statue sat in front of a pool of oil. There is so much oil involved in this statue. And this pool served to keep the area moist, obviously. Must be moist at all times so the ivory didn't crack and degrade. And reflect the light in the room and make the statue seem more alive, like ready to speak or move. It was an unnerving effect. This is what Pausanias tells us about the statue, and he may have seen it, right? Like, he probably did. Quote, "The god sits on a throne, and he is made of gold and ivory. On his head lies a garland, which is a copy of olive shoots. In his right hand, he carries a victory, Nike, which, like the statue, is of ivory and gold. She wears a ribbon, and on her head, a garland. In the left hand of the god is a scepter, ornamented with every kind of metal, and the bird sitting on the scepter is the eagle. The sandals also of the god are of gold, as is likewise his robe." So much gold.
All the gold. This is Phidias. He got in trouble with the gold last time. He likes his gold.
Back to the quote. "On the robe are embroidered figures of animals and the flowers of the lily. The throne is adorned with gold and with jewels, to say nothing of ebony and ivory. Upon it are painted figures and wrought images."
So I wanted to stop here for a minute because the construction of the statue is fascinating. In her book, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, again, Bettany Hughes explains the process that Phidias would have used to manipulate the ivory so that he was able to carve the statue. He used essentially vinegar to make it more pliable and carved the statue from a combination of the highly valuable hippo ivory, rhino, and elephant ivory. Hippo, as I mentioned, was the most valuable. I was totally floored. Like, first off, I love vinegar. I'm just a weirdo who lived in England for a long time, and I love me some vinegar. Apparently, the vinegar helped make the ivory easier to manipulate, and that was super important because Phidias wanted to get that lifelike quality. And the statue itself had a secret door that allowed you to climb inside Zeus's head.
Could you speak from Zeus's head and make people believe that he was speaking, and was this something that priests did?
So you could definitely go inside the head and survey the room, very trippy from like Zeus's head. But I didn't see any evidence that the priests or anyone else actually used this to trick people or make them think that Zeus was talking, probably for fear of like hubris and blasphemy. And also because everyone knew you could go inside the statue, it was just like a feature of it. So tricking them that way might have been a bit pointless. The statue itself, this huge hulking statue, was a testament to winners and losers. In this domain, there was no room for anyone who did not win. This statue and this temple became known as the place that kings would go to before they went to war. Like I said earlier, they would ask for an oracular prediction, and if it came true, they returned and brought spoils to the statue and the temple. It became an incredibly wealthy place.
Because that is literally all we have of the description of the statue of Zeus, we wanted to include another quote from Seven Wonders of the Ancient World that gives us a look at what historians think the statue would have looked like in more detail. And again, this is from Bettany Hughes. Quote, "Measuring the size of a three-story home, 41 feet, on his pedestal rising over 44 feet tall, and yet seated, crouching, he's basically crouching, with his head skimming the ceiling like Alice in Wonderland after taking her drink me spiked potion, the godhead must have seemed extraordinarily intimidating. It was said that if he stood up, this Olympian Zeus would unroof his temple home. With a glistening skin of hippopotamus ivory, this glowering Zeus was decorated with precious stones, polished bone and ebony. Glass lilies were set, and animals were carved into Zeus's robe. Mythological scenes were depicted on his gilded throne. His massive head was crowned with golden olive shoots. Every detail must have been ardently worked over. In Zeus's left hand was a multi-metal scepter, the perch of a glaring eagle, and in his right, a statue of Nike, the winged goddess of victory, itself over 6.5 feet tall."
Isn't that the best description? Can we just stop for a minute? 6.5 feet tall. That is tiny in his hand, but that is like bigger than so many people.
Her next sentence really drives that home. Nike was a mini-me of Zeus, is what Bettany Hughes says. Also, chryselephantine overlaid with gold and ivory. I don't know what chryselephantine is, but it sounds like some kind of precious stone. Also crowned with a wreath made of olive shoots. Coins from Olympia were struck with Nike's image too, not, as it is often erroneously imagined, representing victory in an athletic contest, but victory in war. Zeus's hair curled onto his shoulders, the heft of two heavy locks hinting this hair was also made of gold, and his ivory skin was dressed in perfumed oil to counter the damp of the Altus plain. Oil which then dripped off and formed a pool in a rectangular dark limestone basin rimmed with pentelic marble, so that the domineering deity in this oil slick reflection became twice the god he already was. Wow.
Right?
Could you imagine being like a person from classical Greece just looking up at that? You'd have to believe the gods are real.
Could you imagine being at one end of that pool and he'd be rippling in the pool and then before you? There would be incense. It would be smoky in there. The light filtering through would be strange. It wouldn't be a normal light like you'd get.
The light would be strange and weird and ethereal and like not any other light that you've ever seen.
And we don't know what kind of incense they would have burned, if it would have had any kind of properties, but it could have.
You mean hallucinogenic?
Mm-hmm. You would be there, maybe completely floored by what you're seeing before you and unable to really articulate this god, this statue that looked lifelike, that is before you, reflected in the oil and the water.
It's so oily, so sticky. This is the stickiest part of this very sticky complex.
This very sticky episode. This statue that if he stood up would unroof his actual temple. It's so unimaginable to me.
This was the god at Olympia, a god of absolutes. a god of winners and losers, a god of kings, a god of conquest and war, and he was terrifying. He was unwavering. He was not someone to fuck with.
And for a long time, he stayed right there in that temple, terrifying and awing in equal measure. The men and women who passed him all tried to leave their marks on him. Phidias actually did leave a message on the statue. Phidias' lover, Pentarches, who won a wrestling match in the Olympic Games, is immortalized on Zeus' little finger with the words, "Pentarches is beautiful," carved into the finger. And he's also featured on a relief of Pentarches crowning himself at the feet of the statue.
Aww.
I know. It was a gorgeous, if slightly hubristic, gift from one lover to another.
I mean, I find that so sweet and romantic. I don't think it's hubristic. I think it's romantic.
But the Greeks didn't feel that way because this was their god.
Because love is dead and they didn't love anyone.
I'm not getting into that debate. So Phidias lived on the site at Olympia while the statue was constructed. And we have found his workshop, Jenny. And we know it was his workshop because we can see his tools. And there's a cup that said, "I belong to Phidias." And I think that's hilarious. And now I really want someone to make me a cup that tells everyone that it belongs to me. This is Jen's cup. I belong to Jen.
I don't know what it is about Phidias that's adorable, but I find him adorable. Aw.
After the statue was completed, Phidias fell onto some hard times. Some say that the statue was cursed. A few years after the statue was finished, Phidias was allegedly put to death by the Eleans or the Hellenic people. And that's according to our good friend Aristophanes. We're not sure exactly why he was put to death, possibly from his earlier scandals in Athens. Maybe it was something new. To me, it kind of feels like a sad end for this master artisan, but I also don't have too many details about his life. Maybe he was a dick. I don't want to come out as a Phidias stan in case he was.
But he wasn't the only one who ran afoul of the statue or who was not potentially cursed by the statue, because about 500 years after the statue was completed, everyone's favorite asshat, Caligula. I mean, my favorite asshat is Commodus.
Oh, over Caligula? Sorry, he's my favorite asshat.
You know, King Jackass of the Arena, Commodus, the one jackass to rule them all and in the darkness bind them. Come on. We've been over this. Anyway, so everybody's second favorite asshat, Caligula, decided that he was going to mess with the statue.
Bad idea.
Caligula wasn't making the best decisions, okay? After that fever dream,
he woke up totally different. You're like, yeah, that makes sense.
He woke up totally making bad decisions, and it continued until death, yes. Anyway, so when Caligula became emperor, and I'm assuming that this happened after the fever, he demanded that many famous statues be shipped to Rome so he could knock their heads off and replace them with his head. Good Lord.
He even called this statue like Jupiter or Io at Olympia. Like, he didn't even give it its Greek name because that's what a dick he was.
Anyway, so the people who were supposed to ship the statue of Zeus at Olympia to Caligula were like, hard pass. Hard pass, buddy. They were like, absolutely not. We're not doing this. They did, however, do one of those passive aggressive moves where they made it look like they were going to do it. They set up scaffolding and started to get ready to move it. And they were like, well, this is just going to take an awfully long time. I guess we better build some more scaffolding. Caligula was assassinated before the statue could be moved, which was really ideal for everybody.
I mean, I think they had a feeling that someone was going to kill this bitch. Like, they were like, oh, yeah, we'll do it real slow. It'll take some time. Maybe we can wait out this emperor.
That's a good strategy. So Caligula was assassinated before the statue could be moved. It's said that when the news was told to the workmen in the temple, that the statue let out a huge laugh, so loud that it made the scaffolding and the workmen fall to the floor. Potentially there was somebody in the head laughing.
Potentially, but I also think maybe the statue just started laughing. It was like, fuck that dude. Unfortunately, things continued to get tough for our statue. Over the centuries, the temple sustained raiders because of all that wealth it had accumulated, earthquakes, a particularly bad one in 280 AD, and even fires. Some of the other buildings were cannibalized to protect the statue and the sanctuary. But even through all that, all those horrors, The statue and the temple remained standing. It wasn't until Emperor Theodosius I, Jenny's Theodosius, the guy who fucked it up for Alaric of the Visigoths, the hero of Jenny's novel, when Emperor Theodosius I arrived on the scene, things got really bad for our statue. In 393 AD, the Emperor Theodosius I canceled the Olympic Games. Now, these games had been unbroken from 776 BC until 393 AD. That's 1,169 years of festivals and celebrations. And they were canceled by one emperor. An entire cultural tradition was colonized and destroyed by one dude.
I mean, to be fair, it might have been something that colonized and destroyed a previous tradition of feminine leadership.
It absolutely was. It was colonization on top of colonization.
It's like that mound.
It is that mound. It's exactly that mound. It's such a good analogy for what happened here. Now, I'm not a fan of Theodosius I. He ordered that the temple be looted and vandalized. And then he had it converted into a church. And it kind of remained a church for a while. And this is what Bettany Hughes told us happened to the site that was this temple. Quote, "There would have been a great deal to destroy and loot. By the time of the 269th Olympiad, the altar alone boasted at least 3,000 bronze, wooden, and stone statues and sculptures left by victorious athletes and their grateful communities. Recent research confirms that earthquakes followed by tsunamis finally crashed down the monumental columns of Zeus's temple in that massive geoseismic event that also flooded Olympia's port of Phia. Eventually, covered in landslides from Mount Kronos and sands from the river Calydios, the Olympic site was abandoned by the 9th century AD and was only rediscovered in 1766 and the Temple of Zeus in 1830.
But here's the thing. The statue of Zeus had been removed from the temple long before it was converted. Zeus was taken from his temple first in pieces and then whole cloth. Constantine was the first to strip the statue for parts, mostly for gold and other precious gems. He did this between 306 and 337 AD. But he kept the statue in its temple. In 395 AD, the statue was carefully packaged and shipped to Constantinople as a symbol of the triumph of Christ. According to worldhistory.org, this is what historians believe happened to the statue. Quote, "Constantinople was then the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, where it and the temple or palace it stood in, the statue of Zeus, basically, and the temple or palace it stood in, were destroyed during an earthquake or tsunami in the 5th or more likely 6th century AD. An alternative theory, as recorded in the works of the historians Zonaras and Kedron, is that the statue was destroyed by a fire in 475 AD. Whatever the exact causes of its final loss, the surviving descriptions by ancient writers and the tantalizing images in other ancient artworks and on coins are all that survive of one of the wonders of the ancient world, the only one that was ever genuinely revered." So, it's a little bit confusing to read that for me. So what I understand here is that the statue was moved to Constantinople in 395 AD. And while there, we don't know exactly what happened to it, but we do know that it was eventually destroyed, possibly around 475 AD in the fire or an earthquake. So like it could have been an earthquake or a tsunami in the 5th or 6th century AD, we're not sure. This is all up for debate.
It's all up for debate, and that's really upsetting. It's so sad that this beautiful thing was taken from its home, which had been converted into a church anyway, and then was destroyed. Like, we don't exactly know where it went to rest in Constantinople. If it was out in the public, in a palace, we have no idea. But here's the thing. This is Zeus, fuck daddy Zeus that we're talking about. There's always a twist in his tales. While the statue was lost to us, the image of Zeus's statue at Olympia remains in the strangest of places. You can find the image on ancient coins, particularly some that Alexander the Great minted. You see him seated with Nike in his hands. You can also find the image of Zeus at Olympia in early Christian art, because it seems that Zeus got the last laugh in the end. Now, according to Bettany Hughes, the Christian artists of Constantinople, the city of Constantine, center of the increasingly powerful Christian religion, were so inspired by the majesty of the statue that they created an image of Christ based off it. The Christ ruler of all started appearing in frescoes, mosaics, and other artwork, seated on a throne and glaring impressively, just like a certain Olympian Zeus. John of Damascus in the early 8th century says, quote, he divided the hair into a parting so that his face would not be hidden. For this was the way the Greeks painted Zeus. And we have that incredible description earlier about how Zeus's hair looked in this statue. Now, Bettany Hughes describes Jesus as being remade into a sort of god-king, inspired by the forbidding, glaring, and terrifying image of Olympian Zeus. She tells us that, quote, "In fact, he still stares down today, a one-minute walk across from the Hippodrome, from where the Zeus statue was possibly last seen, in the fine golden mosaics of the Hagia Sophia, the church built by the Emperor Justinian and the Empress Theodora, which, rumor had it, also preserved columns from another wonder, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus." We'll get there.
Some historians even suggest that the image of Abraham Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial is based on the statue of Zeus at Olympia, and that actually makes a lot of sense, given the hard-ons that the founding fathers had for Greco-Roman democracy. I mean, that's true. So I've been to see the Lincoln Memorial, and Lincoln he's sitting on a chair, and he's carved in heroic size, so larger than life. I could be misremembering this because I did a Google search just to remind myself of what this looked like. And he's either inside of like a...
He's in a portico.
So he's kind of in an inside-outside space. The ceiling is high. Like, it's a lot higher than his head. So he doesn't look like if he stood up, he would break the ceiling. You know, he's not quite that tall. But he does have this sort of forbidding countenance kind of staring down at you. So Abraham Lincoln might be personifying just like a fraction of the grandeur and the terror and the awe of the Olympian Zeus. Like, that might be one of the places you could go to just get a little piece of it, just a tiny piece of it today.
Yeah.
While this wonder is lost to us in modern times, we can look around in the ancient and modern world and see traces of the glowering God King staring down at us from the centuries, judging us. We can see how he evolved from a mound of ash in Olympia to a statue, and then into the artwork of early Christians, and finally back to a statue seated in the capital of the United States, who maybe is a little bit more chill, just like, you know, potentially 60% more chill than the Zeus at Olympia. The old gods never really die, do they? They just change their shapes. So that's it for this week.
And that's it for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. We are, as always, on the socials. We are very rarely on X these days, or Twitter. I mean, fuck X. So mostly we are on Threads and Facebook and Instagram and occasionally TikTok. We are at Ancient History Fangirl. We are most active on Instagram. We're a little more active on Threads, Facebook, and TikTok. We do sometimes put updates on. Come and say hello to us. We love talking to you all and connecting with you. We are also super excited. I'm saying this because Jenny does not know I'm going to say this. I didn't script it. Our girl Jenny wrote a book. It's going to be published on February 5th, 2025 by Harlequin Publishers. It is called Enemy of My Dreams. It is a smutty, sexy romp through ancient Rome featuring Jenny's boyfriend Alaric of the Visigoths and a heroine with spicy red hair like me named Julia. It's not based on me. It is so good.
It'd be awkward if I based her on you. I feel like it'd be a little incestuous.
It would be Ptolemy-level awkward.
No, awkward, awkward.
Anyway, I just want to shout about this as much as I can. It's not quite up for pre-order yet, but it will be soon. Keep that in your mind, Enemy of My Dreams. It is absolutely incredible. I have read this book across the decade, pretty much, in various stages. I am so proud of our Jenny, and I hope that you all will pre-order it and be proud of her too. She's too stoic in Vermont. She can't gush like this, but I'm a drunk Long Islander. I can gush.
Thank you, Jen. I'm a little bit embarrassed, but also thank you. I'm flattered. If you want to join my mailing list, I do have that up. It's at jennywilliamsonauthor.com. If there is any news to share, I will share it on the mailing list and also probably on our Patreon.
And obviously also, I'm just going to shout about it all the time because I can't stop because I'm a very supportive Leo. We have some patrons to thank this month. Our Patreon is what keeps this podcast running. We could not run it without the support of our patrons. And our patrons get all kinds of extra goodies. They get to hear me drunkenly talk about mythology. They get to get some sneak peeks of the fiction that we're working on. They get to get extra episodes. It's a great place to be and hang out. If you're able to, please support us on Patreon because literally that is how the podcast keeps running.
You can find the Patreon at patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl, and we do have some patrons to thank. Apologies in advance if we mispronounce anyone's name. We really hope we don't.
Thank you so much to Zoe Rose.
Kylie, just Kylie.
Vincent Jorgensen.
Roxy Sullivan.
Rubberband Disaster. I love that.
Ray, just Ray.
Morgan Gano.
Ian Mott.
Kirby Carlson.
Chloe, just Chloe.
Caitlin Cook.
Chloe Pietragala.
Jaden, just Jaden.
Girl Bookworm.
Noah Sachs.
Abby Moxon Carter.
Hannah Lee.
Kristen Grisham.
McKenna Vanderpoel.
Jamie Elizabeth.
And Jamian, just Jamian.
Thank you all so much for your support. And thank you all so much for listening. And we will see you whenever we see you next.